Well, it's Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett, and we've got a big show tonight. Two guests splitting the show down the middle, both with aspects kind of the same thing. Is how can we tell when we're getting the whole story, and who do you trust when it comes down to a couple of big issues? Like Andy Ramirez later on will join us. He's the president of the Law Enforcement Officers Advocates Council. We're talking about the case against Jesus Enrique Diaz, who's the Border Patrol agent who was prosecuted at the request of the Mexican consul and given a very strong sentence for lifting up somebody who had been handcuffed. More on that later. It sounds unbelievable until you hear the story. And then, you know, we have to also decide what we're going to do about that. We'll talk about that later on Coast to Coast. We're also going to talk about this new book out, which is ostensibly a novel, but it's based on research that was done since the killing of Osama bin Laden. And the author of the first half of the show, John Wiseman, is going to talk to us about the myths concerning the death of Osama bin Laden, what he's been able to uncover, what is told in his book as a novel or in fiction when it is entirely based on fact. So to get around the idea of printing government secrets, that sort of thing, you don't have to worry about that so much when you're dealing with a novel. And we'll talk about what he was able to uncover in just a minute. And especially interesting that it happened this week. The book is dropping, and this information is coming out this week. When it the corpse of Osama bin Laden was handled on the USS Carl Vinson, which is where they just had that basketball game, right? Versus when they had Michigan State versus North Carolina, and the president was there for that—the first floating basketball game they've ever had in college hoops. Before we get to either of those situations, so I want to tell you a quick story. And I will, I'll actually tweet out a picture from this here in just a few minutes. My Twitter account is Deacon Punnett. If you're on Twitter, DeaconPunnett. So I like to send out photos, and I send out some funny stuff during the week, and I love it when you all respond, and I like to be able to keep in touch with you that way. But I'm going to send out a photo that was taken earlier tonight when I was at the opening of a new opera. Now, ordinarily, you might think about operas being incompatible maybe with Coast to Coast or most things, but I happen to love opera, and I go all the time, and I'm involved in a couple of different productions for one reason or another. In this case, it's the production of Silent Night, which is being performed for the first time in Minnesota, and then it'll be going on around the rest of the world after that. And it's the story of the famous 1914 World War I Christmas truce. And so, like the Nutcracker, obviously, has become sort of a Christmas favorite. There's a belief that this could end up being a real holiday classic. It's a beautifully told story of the famous truce that was called on the battlefield between German, Scottish, and French troops during World War I and lasted for about 24 hours before they went back to shooting at each other. And it's a great story, and it's marvelously staged. Even can't imagine how you could stage like a battlefield scene out of, you know, something like the size of an opera stage, but they've worked it out, and it's just wonderful. But as I'm approaching there tonight, there was a color guard of bagpipers there to represent the Scottish. And then as I went inside, there was a couple of announcements before the opening night tonight. This is the world premiere. And they announced before the show was to start that the lead tenor, one of the main characters in the performance of Silent Night, had lost his voice. He was having a silent night, I guess we could say. He had developed laryngitis, and, you know, usually with an opera, there's 15 other people who have sung that part in the cast. You know, if you're doing La Boheme or Pagliacci or something, you know, everybody's done the parts at one time or another who've been around opera long enough. And So it wouldn't have been hard to find somebody. But again, this is the world premiere. This is the first time this would ever been performed. They didn't have anybody else. In fact, there was only one other person who had ever sung this part, period. And that was in a workshop earlier this summer in which they were testing out some of the roles. There's a point to this story. So what they had to do was they found the guy who had sung the part for this new opera that debuted tonight. They put him off to the side of the stage with a microphone. And they had the guy who lost his voice, but who was the only person who knew all the blocking, you know, knew all the cues, knew all the in and out. He went out and he lip-synced. And they announced this before the opera began. They said the part will be lip-synced. And the audience gave a very hearty round of applause and cheers for this, that the opera was going to go on. And you know, that's what they did. And then the color guard came out. And I have to say, you know, it was like two remarkable moments kind of back-to-back. The color guard came out. Because of Veterans Day yesterday, they had arranged for, and I'd never seen this before, although I'm sure it's been done before. Before the opera began, the orchestra went into the national anthem, and the entire opera audience stood up and sang the national anthem in honor of the people who lost their lives during World War I, in honor of the troops that were being honored on Veterans Day. And the color guard marched around inside of the auditorium. I just never seen anything like that before. It was like before a baseball game, sure, but not an opera. And then they left and everybody sat down and the performance went on. And it just goes to show you how dedicated we are, that even in a crowd like that, which you wouldn't necessarily think of, maybe kind of an artsy crowd, they're just as patriotic as the rest of us. And they stood and they sang and they applauded afterward. And there wasn't really a dry eye as the color guard left the Performing Arts Center and went out the door and joined the bagpipers outside. So I say that to you because I too share that kind of patriotism. I think we all do in one form or another. And maybe information like we're going to hear from this new book about Osama bin Laden and the killing of Osama bin Laden may be kind of challenging for some people. I just ask you to be a little bit patient with it. It's a very interesting story, and we will address the five myths that are currently floating around right now, which our author next has uncovered in the killing of bin Laden, and we'll set the record straight. Coming up in just a minute on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. Well, there's always great stories at coasttocoastam.com. I strongly encourage you to take a look at this mystery radiation that has been detected across Europe. This is a story that's still developing, but as the early test results are showing, something's going on. Nobody knows quite where it's coming from or how many people may be affected by it, but there is essentially a cloud of radiation that's getting over across Europe in some places stronger than others, and the whole story is waiting for you at coasttocoastam.com, along with that photo of the invisibility cloak, if you look close enough, you know what I mean? It's a video about the story about the University of Texas Dallas physicist who demonstrated an invisibility cloak, which I'm pretty sure is something that Texas Governor Rick Perry wished he had had earlier in the week when he was at the GOP debate and couldn't remember that third thing he wanted to say for 55 seconds. Invisibility cloak would have come in really handy right about then. But the full story is up at coasttocoastam.com. Take a look with that, along with some 11111 coincidences, right? All of the 11 coincidences. I was tweeting about that too earlier in the week, and it was always nice to hear back from you guys on that. So heading into this busy show tonight, I'll take a minute again to recognize this book is just out. In fact, let me jump in and bring in John Wiseman on the air. Good morning, John.
Morning, Ian.
All right. So let me ask you, or evening in some places, let me ask you about the book. Your book is not officially out, or because I thought I saw a release date of the 15th. So let me double check on that.
The official pub date is the 15th, and it's going to be in stores on that date. It's available for pre-order on Amazon right now, whether it's in hardcover or Kindle.
Okay. That's good. I just want to make sure that people, but this is wonderful that you're willing to come on a few hours early before the official release, and then I hope drum up some very strong interest in this novel. I don't have it in my hands, obviously, because it's not out yet, so I didn't have a chance to read it, but I'm really interested. KBL is the nickname that the book has picked up, and it's all about Kill Bin Laden, the novel based on true events, KBL. Now, before we get into what you were able to uncover, let's talk about some of the other books you've written in the past and how much research into true events has played into some of your previous work.
Sure.
What are you known for, and how hard is it to get people to tell you things that they could otherwise tell 60 Minutes? Or tell, you know, a documentarian, but that they tell you that you're able to use in a novel like this?
Well, the most recent series of books I've done deals with the Central Intelligence Agency. And it's always interesting when you're dealing with agency operations to see who will talk and who won't. I think much of the time, people will talk to me because I write fiction. If you're writing nonfiction, you've got to have source notes, you've got to have footnotes, you've got to have reporting notes if you're going to be taking seriously. When you're writing fiction, you can actually get at the truth of something without having to do any of that if you research properly. And there are a couple of things I've found in the past few years. One is that a lot of material about intelligence is available open source. In other words, on the internet, in newspapers, in magazines, a little tidbit here, a little tidbit there. And if you put them together, you come up with a kind of holistic picture of what's going on. And that's the same sort of research I did for KBL, in which I used not just interviews with people in the military and people in the intelligence community and people in the political community, but also looking at blogs and looking at online information and looking at publications in Pakistan and in India and in the United States and various other places to try and put together a holistic picture of what that whole operation Sure. was about.
So do you find the sources, or do the sources come to find you?
Well, you've got to dig them out, and sources are it's an interesting question that you pose, because people think that you go into someone's office and interview them and they give you the whole picture all at once, and that of course is not the case. I spent 20 years as a Washington journalist, and in the course of that, you develop a number of sources that you rely on for stories, and many of those I've stayed with, and many of those have stayed with me, and so you develop a deep Rolodex, and so when you want to do a story about covert action at the CIA, or you want to do a story about how the Bin Laden operation was put together, you go back to those people because they're professionals and they're in their fields. And you try and plumb them for right. information.
Okay, so some of the criticism about KBL, Kill Bin Laden, again, is what we're talking about. The book is not yet out, but it's coming. Has also already come out that some people who, and I don't know whether they've had a chance to read the book or not, but they, in some quotes I have seen, they challenge you on whether or not you could have gotten this information, which we're going to uncover here in just a moment, that you could have gotten this information, that this sounds like something which a fiction writer couches as being sourced material, but that nobody would have actually have told you these things.
Well, I actually haven't seen criticism like that yet. That may indeed happen. I think that were this a nonfiction book, I would be challenged simply because I don't have sourcing notes. I don't have reportorial notes in it. It being fiction, it's much easier to talk to people about the way operations are run, simply because they know that it's not going to be sourced back to them. In other words, I don't have to, as a newspaper journalist would do, have to say, well, according to a SEAL Team 6 SEAL, this or that happened.
Okay.
Now, have I spoken to SEALs who work in what is now called the Naval Special Warfare Development Group? Sure.
Right.
Do I know that these are the same SEALs that participated in the Bin Laden raid? Nope. And the reason I don't know is because they're forbidden to say so.
Right.
They're certainly not going to tell me. Have I talked to active people at the Central Intelligence Agency? Yes, I have. Would they tell me stuff that is classified? No. Nor should they, by the way. And what you've got to do, though, is let these people point you in the right direction.
Okay. Well, and I think what's fair is the description I've read said that your book gives the first full account of the raid that killed Osama bin Laden, and that that you have the details that other people don't. And when the book comes out, people should read it and make that decision for themselves, even though, as we discussed, this is written in terms of a novel, but it is not fictional information, as you have been maintaining. So based on these true events that you were able to uncover, let's start from the beginning. There's been this, question in some people's minds as to whether or not Osama bin Laden was actually killed at that compound in Abbottabad. So let's address that one up front. As far as the information that you have, the best information you have, is that really was the place where he was killed, correct?
Oh, yes. And I have seen stuff on the Internet about the fact that certain people have posited the story that bin Laden died years ago and that the raid in Abbottabad was staged by the White House as a way of getting President Obama reelected. And to me, that requires the same kind of conspiracy that we heard back in 2001 from some people who thought that President Bush staged the Twin Towers collapse.
Well, let's just,
that does is it requires the conspiracy of tens of thousands of people without a single whistleblower, and it just kind of strains credulity, doesn't it?
Okay. Well, but except that in this case, there were many people who were in print, who had come forward even by name and said that they had been told that Osama bin Laden was dead. Many of them were in the military. Many of them had been, there are people who maintain to this day that they were told back in 2000 and, fill in the blank, that Osama bin Laden was already dead, and that the United States had the body of Osama bin Laden on ice and were waiting for an opportunity to do something with it. And yet I thought that you had there's at least an explanation for that, in that the military was, in fact, perhaps in some circles, or the CIA was, they did have a reason to tell people that Osama bin Laden was already dead, correct?
Well, they had a perfect reason to tell that Osama bin Laden was dead, because SEAL Team 6 killed him.
Well, I meant before that.
and I'll get back to that. That before SEAL Team 6, before Abbottabad, on how that story got started about Osama bin Laden having already been killed. Hang on for that, then. I'll give you a minute, and then we'll come right back. Because this is the first full account of the raid that killed Osama bin Laden, and I don't want to get into the weeds right away, because you'll be able to hear for the first time exactly what happened moment by moment. And there weren't, you know, it was a lot fewer moments than we were led to believe originally. But by using fiction, John Weissman doesn't have to go through the whole the footnote thing and the whole, you know, anonymous source thing. So just know that up front. But this is a very interesting story, and he'll be able to tell us a little bit more about that coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Doing kind of a two and two tonight. Two guests each getting 2 hours tonight of Coast to Coast. John Weissman is our first one. We're going to talk to him about his new book, KBL, Kill Bin Laden. And we'll tell you more about what he was able to uncover about the first full account of what happened inside the compound at Abbottabad next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. So we were talking about KBL, Kill Bin Laden, and I threw out that first question for you because I've been really curious about this. There are many people here who have called in at Coast to Coast over the last couple of years who have said, and there are other talk show hosts who maintain, that Osama bin Laden was killed many years ago and that they heard it directly from somebody within the military. And I'd read, and so this is why I threw it out to you, that may have been an intentional cover that was either being asserted by the Central Intelligence Agency or military intelligence as a way of sort of making it appear as though we weren't going after him, that we had lost interest, which was part of an intentional effort to be able to concentrate on these people, these couriers or others that we thought were going to lead us to him. Is that something you had not heard in the preparation for the book?
That is something I had not heard in the preparation for this book.
Okay.
No.
Fair enough. But in this case, though, I mean, we had also been told that Pakistan didn't have any idea where Osama bin Laden was. And that even though he was found literally like within a mile of the front gate of Pakistan's West Point, Pakistan said, no, we don't know who we would tell you if we knew where he is, but we don't know where he is.
That is true. And we have known for a long time that the Pakistanis have been playing a double game. Pakistan for years has, for example, sent liaison officers with American or NATO troops, ISAF troops, in Afghanistan. And it has been established that these liaison officers were relaying information back that was then turned around and used by the insurgents, the Taliban, the Haqqani network, against the ISAF forces. So when Pakistan said, oh, we have no idea that bin Laden was in Abbottabad, you have to treat that with a grain of salt simply because of the history of it. Did everybody in the Pakistani government know where bin Laden was? No. But did certain elements of the Pakistani intelligence community know? Probably they did. I mean, I can't prove that they did, but it makes sense that they did because they have been active for years in supporting the Taliban and in dealing with al-Qaeda.
In your research for the book, how far back had the CIA been floating agents around Pakistan? Where were they operating out of? And how much of their information was primary? I mean, what were they seeing themselves versus what they were hearing from other sources?
Well, from what I have been able to discover or have been told, obviously the CIA has been operating in Pakistan for years and years and years. In terms of where they have operated out of, it makes sense to assume that they, on a on a quasi-official basis, operate out of the consulates in Karachi and in Peshawar and in Lahore and in the capital of Islamabad. One would like to hope that they also have established agent networks of locals, in other words, Pakistanis, who operate in other areas. We also can extrapolate, given knowledge of what the American intelligence community is capable of, that we are probably operating drones over Pakistan from time to time that have intelligence gathering capabilities.
Well, I hope so. I mean, I would.
Yeah, you and me.
I would imagine we would. But okay. But let's go back. Does the CIA then maintain a series of safe houses in Pakistan where agents operate and hit the streets and have been trying to find bin Laden in Pakistan for years before the raid?
Well, I don't. That I can't speak to. I don't know that they've operated safe houses for years. Given the way CIA works, there are probably safe houses in Pakistan. The particular one in Abbottabad was established, as far as I can determine, in the summer/fall of 2010. They established it there because they were able to identify a couple of elements that made it worthwhile for them to take the risk of establishing a safe house in basically what would be called a hostile area. Okay. And that evidence was the fact that there were two individuals who were known to be bin Laden couriers who had bought a compound in Abbottabad and who lived there with their families, and the compound itself warranted attention simply because it was different than any other residential compound in the city.
And different because?
Well, it was much larger. It had no telephone or satellite capabilities. It had high walls, walls that were as high as 18 feet. It had surveillance cameras on the outside. The side of the house, the main house, which was three stories, that faced the street, all the windows were opaque.
Right.
In other words, you could not see in. On the opposite side, there was on the third floor a terrace, but the terrace had a 7-foot-high privacy wall to it. Most other houses in Abbottabad, just about every other one, used garbage collection.
Right.
In this particular compound, the garbage was burned on a regular basis.
Hmm.
Nobody was let in. The compound was basically kept private. And since it had been bought by people of interest to the CIA long about the summer of 2010, so I was told, a safe house was set up to monitor the comings and goings.
Right. How long in your information, in your research, how long did we know that it was Osama bin Laden, or we were 80% sure that it was Osama bin Laden that was in that compound?
Well, I think it took a long time. I mean, there were, for example, because there were no telephones going in and out, you couldn't tap the lines. Because there were no communications going in and out, you couldn't eavesdrop. What the agency and the intelligence community was able to do, from what I was told, is to set up in this safe house long-distance monitoring equipment so that, for example, if people came out, they could pick up what they were saying as they drove away. There were a few cell phone calls that came and went to the compound, and those were monitored. During one of those calls, a code word was used, a code word that the intelligence agencies knew referred to bin Laden. And that code word, he was referred to often as the diamond, which in Arabic is almaz. And that term was used, and that was a check mark. Overhead surveillance showed that there was a tall individual who was in that compound. The overhead could not determine that individual's face, but given the time of day and the length of shadow and what have you, it could be analyzed to show that this was an individual 6'4", 6'5", 6'3", 6'4", 6'5". And right. It's known that bin Laden was, 6'4", 6'5". He was uncommonly tall.
It was kind of a human sundial while he was standing there.
Yes.
That's how you measure.
Exactly, Ian. Exactly.
So at some point the decision gets made for this raid. And I thought there's a story that, as I understand it, you have fictionalized in your book. Is it true about the State Department contractor who killed two Pakistani, thugs, hooligans, gang members who were trying to rob him a few months prior to the operation? Was that part of the operation?
Well, in nonfiction, no. But let me say this. In October of 2010, CNN put a story on the air, sourced to a NATO official in Brussels, that bin Laden was not in Waziristan or in the mountain regions on the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan, but that he was living in a compound in northeast Pakistan. And at that point, all sorts of bells and whistles went off at the CIA, because by that point they had established the safe house in Abbottabad. And certainly if you were at the CIA, you didn't want Pakistani intelligence nosing around your safe house, or even guessing that the Americans might be present in Abbottabad. And when Raymond Allen Davis shot two Pakistanis, he was a contractor working for the Central Intelligence Agency. Attention was diverted to that. And fortuitously, it drew the Pakistanis' attention away from Abbottabad, which by happenstance happened to really help the intelligence gathering operation in Abbottabad. In writing fiction, you get a chance to use real life, and this was one instance. If I had been at the CIA, if I were a CIA officer, I would have used the heck out of that incident, because indeed it diverted attention from what was going on in Abbottabad.
It's an interesting part of the story. So let's talk about the raid itself. Again, this is the new novel out called KBL, Kill Bin Laden. It's not available for a couple of days yet. You can pre-order it. You can link up to it very easily by going to coasttocoastam.com. So, John, tell me about the actual raid. How we hear varying reports about all sorts of aspects of it. You tell the story. From when they landed in the helicopter, and was it a top secret helicopter afterward? I mean, have we lost all these secrets now that this helicopter kind of crashed there in the garden courtyard?
The Pakistanis have allowed the Chinese and various other people to look at the tail part of the wreckage. I mean, the helicopter itself was kind of broken in two. You had the the forward part of it inside the courtyard, and on the tail part came down outside the wall. That's the part that has been photographed many, many times. The part that came down inside the courtyard was completely destroyed by the air crew and by the SEALs, because they carried explosives with them to do just that. And yes, it was and is. I mean, that's a it's a version of the Black Hawk helicopter that operates a lot more silently and a lot more stealthily than your everyday version of the Black Hawk.
Okay, so that's the one they took in, and then walk us through it. Just as you understand now, for as you say in the book, the first time we understand the true events of what happened. What happened?
Well, the raiding party came in using stealth capabilities to divert any possible radar detection. How they did that is secret, but you can determine that obviously they were using electronic countermeasures so that Pakistani radar did not pick them up. Much of the Pakistani radar, by the way, faces India, which made it somewhat easier for the Americans who came from the opposite direction to get in. The raid itself was the same kind of high-value target raid that SEALs and Delta Force people and Rangers have been doing for years. I mean, last year, according to Admiral Bill McRaven, who was at that point the head of the Joint Special Operations Command and now runs the SOCOM, U.S. SOCOM, out of Tampa, they did 1,700 of these types of raids last year. And the major difference between that and any other raid that they did is that this one was a deep end run into Pakistan. But the template was the same, which is you come in fast, you get in and get out within 30 minutes, and much of that time you use to do what they call sensitive site exploitation, which is the gathering of intelligence, picking up computers, hard drives, pen drives, laptops, disks, everything you can get your hands on, papers, diaries, pocket litter, all of that sort of thing.
Do they have a contingency to get Osama bin Laden out alive?
These raids are called capture-kill raids. And
right.
In this case, it turned out to be a kill as opposed to a capture raid.
So they really didn't have if he said I'll tell you everything. If he threw up his hands and said I'll tell you everything, just take me out of here alive, would we have had a way of getting him out of there?
Sure, they would have thrown him on a helicopter and brought him out.
Okay, so they were able to do it.
They were able. Yes. Was that a capability that they had? Sure. The question then becomes, of course, is that what you want to do? Do you want that individual around? I don't know what went on in the room when he was shot. Nobody does. Nobody's talking about it. And I truly believe that anybody who tries to describe exactly what went on in that room is like me writing fiction.
Well, that's interesting, because there are some accounts out now that say exactly, they make a claim to what happened inside the room.
Well, I've heard four or five versions of what, the White House has its version of what went
right
on in that room.
Can I read you one of them and see whether or not, based on the information you were able to get for the book Kill Bin Laden, whether this sounds like a likely scenario or not? Okay, we'll get to that coming up in just a second. Getting to the truth behind the SEAL Team 6 raid. And then onto the body disposal as well, exactly what that was all about, and why was it handled the way it was handled. I want to ask John Weissman about that, too. The book is KBL, and it's just coming out. Coming up about an hour from now, we'll talk with an expert on the case of an American agent that was tried at the request of the Mexican consul on a charge you just have a hard time believing. It just seems crazy to think what's going to be happening to this guy. We'll get to that an hour from now on Coast to Coast. And your questions and comments are the way, too, for KBL this hour.